You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about imposter syndrome. And I have to say, I dug pretty deep for this episode. I did lots of academic type reading. I did lots of reading around the subject. And then I also spoke to like family and friends, specifically women, to kind of get their experiences with imposter syndrome. And then, of course, I have my own experiences with imposter syndrome to draw from. And I dug deep because, you know, my general feeling was that there is one version of imposter syndrome that I'm going to talk about now, and another version of imposter syndrome that I think is the actual cause of imposter syndrome in most of the people that it affects. Now, the one that we hear all the time, like, you know, if you pick up a random article on the subject, it'll be talking about the version of imposter syndrome where you, regardless of who you are, feel essentially like you are masquerading as somebody that you are not. It tends to show up more in the professional sphere, I guess, because it's much more easy to compare yourself to other people. There's lots of power dynamics at play, and there's like a lot of pressure to fit in professionally in lots of different ways. So a lot of the time people feel like they're imposters in their roles because they feel that other people are in their positions because of their qualifications, because they've earned their place at the table, essentially. And they, in contrast, feel as though they've almost like tricked people into being in that position. And if they feel that they've tricked somebody to get there, so they've tricked the hiring managers, they've tricked their other colleagues into believing that they ought to be there, it basically tells you that the person has an underlying feeling that they don't themselves deserve to be there. And if we dig a little bit deeper, it also is connected to them feeling like maybe they're not smart enough to be there. Maybe they don't have the right qualifications. Maybe they don't have like the natural smarts that they interpret other people as having. And because of all those reasons and a few more, they end up walking around in their workplace environments feeling like at any moment somebody is going to find out that they shouldn't be there. When somebody is feeling generally that way, it means that they're always fearful of making mistakes because they feel that the mistakes are going to be revealing of the things that they don't know, essentially. You'll find that they'll overthink little things, even like sending a simple internal email will take longer than it should be because they're so paranoid about how they're coming across, that they're being well received by the recipient, and that they're not revealing like the fact that they don't belong there in any of the things that they say. So overthinking things, paranoia is going to be a staple of how somebody feels when they're feeling like they're an imposter. Another staple as well is going to be a generalized fear of not meeting other people's expectations. So you're not necessarily just afraid, by the way, like fearful of superiors. So it isn't just that you're walking around being afraid that you're going to expose yourself to your manager as not being good enough, or that you're just going to expose yourself to people at the same level as not being good enough. It can actually also just come from a fear of not meeting expectations for people who you feel like you ought to. So a lot of nurses, for example, will feel as though they're letting down their patients, or feel as though they're not giving the best of themselves, or they're not in the best place to be giving the kind of care that their patients deserve. So in this case, it's somebody who's dependent on us as opposed to somebody who's our equal or somebody who is our superior. This can also be evident in just like, you know, I've ever met like parents who are just afraid that they're not doing a good job with their kids or with their familial obligations or being a good spouse. And it's not necessarily connected in what the patients have said or what their children have said or what their partners have said. It's just a generalized fear that they're not doing a good job at the job that they should be doing a good job at. Now, going back to the workplace imposter syndrome, a lot of the time it shows up when you feel like you're not reflected in the majority. Because by definition, if you are one of a few or the odd one out, then you are going to be holding yourself to the standard of the majority. And that's generally how social creatures behave. Like, you walk into a room and you kind of read the room, and whatever is what the average person is doing or what the majority of people are doing, you kind of try to assimilate to that. So if you walk into a room and you are the odd one out, or you're one of the few, the natural tendency is to compare yourself to the majority group. And the reason why you end up feeling like an imposter is because you are not being reflected in what you're seeing. And so you try to mold yourself, one, to that majority group, but also a seed at the back of your mind has been planted that is telling you that you don't belong, that you don't fit in, that, you know, you're kind of like an exception to the rule, and that typically you shouldn't be in that role. But for some reason, and a lot of people who suffer from imposter syndrome or imposter phenomenon attribute that reason as being not good enough or it being due to luck. And so the way that a lot of people naturally respond is they put themselves under a tremendous amount of pressure to learn the majority group's ways, like how they talk, how they act, how they behave, like what their backgrounds are. And the person who's feeling this way tries to mirror that back. They either try to mirror it or mimic it or find some way of not sticking out from that majority group. And the reason why they don't fit in from that majority group, outside the obvious like racial majority or gender majority. So if you work, for example, in an all-white space and you're a person of color, or you work in a male-dominated industry or environment and you're a woman, then naturally, of course, we know that you're going to feel like the odd one out because you are the odd one out. Other reasons, though, that people feel like they're imposters or don't fit in with their environment and end up feeling inferior in some way can also be just due to things like class. So if you know, like, let's say you come from like a lower income family and then you find yourself in like a more prestigious environment than maybe was projected for you, then you are going to be reminded of little things all the time. So if you don't come from a family that goes skiing, for example, and then all your colleagues, when you go into the office and you're talking about what your plans are for the summer, they're talking about expensive type hobbies or expensive type trips like skiing or, I don't know, going scuba diving or going to the mountains or going to fancy expensive places. If you know at the back of your head that all you're going to do at most is like a cheeky little trip to Spain, or maybe you're going to stay domestic and go to like a beach nearby, then there can be a feeling that, ooh, like I stand out. I don't want to reveal that I come from a poor background by revealing what my summer plans are, because obviously from what people are talking about in a very casualized sense, clearly I don't fit in terms of like income bracket or background or class or familial wealth, or, and sometimes it's not just in the wealth domain, it also can come to things like education. So I'm sure a lot of you have had the experience as I've had, where you go into a workplace and when people ask you about yourself, you don't get the sense that they're trying to find out what your hobbies are. Like, what do you enjoy doing? Like, what kind of food do you like doing? What kind of entertainment do you like? It often feels like the initial couple of times you talk to new people, it feels like they're trying to find out like what your educational background is, what your family's background is, basically what your wealth status or socioeconomic background is. And then after that's established, then people get to know other parts of you. But it often feels like that. It feels like that in work settings. It feels like that even when you're talking to a random stranger in a coffee house and you start talking about yourselves. Often the first question they'll be asked of you is a question that's sort of like feeling for like who you are, like in those tick box ways, like income, family, wealth, that kind of thing. So if you're the person who's the odd one out because you find yourself in a place where many people like you aren't, naturally you're not going to be reflected in the people around you, not just physically or how they look in terms of gender, for example, but also just background, things like how they grew up, what kind of schools they went to, what kind of expectations family and friends and the environment had for them, what kind of universities they went to, what kind of things they do for fun. All those things are going to be different because you are different people coming from different backgrounds. So naturally, the person who is on the outside of the majority group finds themselves all the time in these micro situations that reflect the fact that they are different in some way. And by the way, it isn't just difference if we are honest about it, because, you know, difference inherently is never bad. It's that it's indifferent and you feel like you're at a disadvantage for whatever reason. Now, imposter, like feelings of being an imposter, end up showing up in lots of different types of ways. Like an example of this is like deference to others. You'll find yourself, like, more often than you would like, always assuming that you are wrong and that other people are correct. In it can be in like opinions, like, what do you think about this and what do you think about that, and whatever they say, you automatically assume that they're correct. It can also show up in decisions when it comes to like business decisions or workplace decisions. Whatever other people's opinions are, you'll never fight for your opinion, even though like you might know that you are definitely in the right, because at the back of your mind you think it's risky to put my opinion out there in case I'm wrong. And also, by the way, I think that I probably am wrong and that they probably know better. So you find yourself just always being deferential to others. You're overly invested in being liked by them. You're trying hard to blend in with them. And therefore, more often than not, whatever they say, you acquiesce to, and you do it agreeably as well. Like, you're not trying to advocate for your opinions. You're not trying to fight for your corner. You're not like acquiescing reluctantly. You know, you do it very quickly. Like, you know, if anybody's opinion comes into conflict with yours, of course the other person is right. So the deference to others is one big thing. The other thing is, if you're walking around being deferential to others and always letting them believe that they are right and never advocating for yourself, it also necessarily translates to how you're going to behave in terms of going up the ladder, because you're not going to be going for opportunities, because that requires you to have a self-belief that you deserve that promotion, that you are the best out of the lot of people who are going for that promotion, and that you're going to have a high standard in and high standard of self-belief, because they're some of the things that a person needs to put themselves up for opportunities. So because you're not in the position where you can stand up for yourself or advocate for yourself or put yourself out there, because again, at the back of your mind, you always feel like you're lucky to be there and that you were there by luck. And at the back of your mind, you always assume that the other people are correct. And even when you know that you are correct and they are wrong, you don't want to stand out by being too vigorous in how you fight for yourself. So a lot of the time, you're going to end up feeling as though there's a lack of fulfillment in your career. Because sooner or later, you know, when you're walking around not being yourself, you're not going to be connecting with the people around you. When you're going around not advocating for yourself and not using your voice to speak for what you believe is the good option or what is correct, then it means you're never going to get that validation from the people around you that you have good ideas and good thoughts. And on top of that, when you are not going for opportunities because you don't believe you deserve them, then naturally you're never going to feel satisfied in any role. And that's why there's a tendency for there to be a high rate of changing jobs, like going from job to another job to another job, because after a while you become like a wound up clock where you can only take so much. You know, after a while of being in a place where you are stifling yourself and the environment is stifling you as well, naturally you need that release valve, and you end up just leaving to another place and essentially doing the same thing. And because, you know, you're walking around with all this turmoil in your mind, where you're having all these thoughts of inferiority, all these pressures to conform and to blend in and to not stick out and to not reveal that you shouldn't be there, your mental health is going to take a kick. It's going to take a kick because the track in your mind is inherently negative. If you believe that you don't deserve to be in a space, and you believe that other people are better than you in all these big and small ways, and you're always stifling your voice and not expressing yourself, and you're also not connecting with the people around you, because for true connection to take place, authenticity is required, and authenticity requires being self-revelatory. It requires you to be open in some way about yourself and who you are and what you believe and what you think. And so if you're not doing that, it's going to limit the connections that you have around you. So all these things are going to mean that in your mind, you're always catastrophizing. Like, you're always thinking about the worst case scenario, like small mistakes in your head. You think that they're massive mistakes that are going to come back and haunt you. And so you're having this negative track in your head. You're having this negative self-speak. And then on top of that, the environment is reflecting what you believe, because if you believe that you're the odd one out and you isolate yourself from your colleagues and you don't connect with them authentically because you're not being yourself, then you're going to receive from the environment that you are the odd one out, that you don't belong, that you don't have connections with other people, because it's a self-fulfilling cycle at that stage. Now, there are like more obvious ways that, you know, just show that you feel like an imposter and you feel like you don't belong. But there are a lot of other non-obvious ways. So one of the things is even just how you show up physically. So like, you'll often notice that when you're in this headspace, you are literally trying to make yourself as small as possible. So you'll walk into an office meeting, and instead of just going and finding a seat in the center or at the front or on the side where you're going to be visible as you walk through the room, you'll probably opt for like a seat at the back or a seat in the corner, or you'll even walk in sort of like semi-crouched because you don't want anybody to notice you. The physical dimension will also show up in the kind of voice that you use. So instead of using, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I have like two voices. I've got like my voice that I use in like professional settings, and then I've got my voice that I use with like my friends and family. No, I actually have three voices. And then I probably have the voice where I'm trying to make myself small for whatever reason. And when you are in this space of feeling like an imposter, you have that voice as well. That voice of trying to make yourself small, or trying to like ingratiate yourself with other people, but it isn't coming from a position of strength. It's coming from a position of weakness. And therefore the voice is like usually a meek voice where you're prone to stuttering or talking too quickly. Either way, it communicates a lack of being sure in yourself and a desire to make yourself small so your voice won't project. It's a meek voice, it's a stuttering voice, because you're trying to minimize who you are in the presence of others in the hopes that they won't notice that you shouldn't be there, essentially. You'll also, like another little physical thing that'll show up is that you, believe it or not, are going to come across as being inauthentic, because your smile will be plastic, because you're not smiling because you're generally happy. You're smiling a lot of the time out of fear. A lot of the time you're smiling because you want to be perceived as being likable and you want to be liked. And therefore it's going to have a forced quality or a plastic quality, because it isn't coming from the soul. That you're not smiling because you want to be smiling. You smile as a manipulative tactic, essentially, because you hope that that's going to make yourself be liked by other people. You're also going to have a general fearful aura about you that people can't place, a general nervous energy around you that people can't place. And that, you know, in itself is alienating to other people, because when somebody's afraid and you don't know why they're afraid, or you sense that they're always anxious and worried and you don't know why they're anxious and worried, you can interpret that as them being like deceitful about something. It's almost like you can't quite place your finger on what it is that they're hiding, but it isn't a recipe for connection, because people aren't in our heads when we're having these feelings, which means that they can't see that actually our nervous energy is coming from the fact that we are trying so hard to fit in and to not be noticed and not to reveal that we shouldn't be there. They don't have access to that part of us, to those thoughts, and we certainly aren't going to be forthcoming with our feelings about why it is we're walking around with this nervous disposition. So it can end up connecting or creating a distance between us further, because again, people, well, I mean, even on a general level, like people want to be around like lightheartedness, you know, and anxiety and fearfulness is the opposite of light heartedness. And so that in itself already creates distance between you and people who, you know, like I said in other episodes, like your work colleagues are just your work colleagues. So they're not that emotionally invested in you. So even on a basic level, already that connects, that creates distance. But if the person doesn't know you as well, it can also create a sense that, you know, you're hiding something or there's something that you're afraid is going to be discovered that they find, you know, curious at the very least. Another like non-obvious way that it shows up is it also shows up in even like the choice of clothes that you wear. You know, like I find myself working in like this environment, which by the way was actually a really happy, positive environment. And it was actually my own feelings that made me feel this way at the very beginning. So I'm a young woman, I'm working in the space that's all men, like all, literally every single one of them is men. And not just men, they're all men who are like 50 and above. And so because I'm the odd one out, I'm the youngest person, I come from a completely different background than them. I'm a woman, I'm the only woman, and I'm also like decades younger than the next youngest person. Then I felt as though, I didn't feel this on a conscious level. I only thought about it when I caught myself in the mirror one day. I just found myself little over time, like assimilating to the majority. And in this case, the majority didn't look anything like me, didn't come from the background that I came from or come from. Just we literally have nothing in common as far as looking at us externally or from our socioeconomic backgrounds. And so one day I was going to a meeting with one of my managers who was lovely as pie. And I happened to catch my reflection in, you know, one of those glass buildings. I happened to see myself in the mirror, in the reflection of that building. And I look at him, I look at myself, I look at him, and I realize I have morphed into like this old white man, like in the most respectful way possible. Like I'm wearing brogues when I tend to wear like at least a little wedge or a little heel when I'm at work. I was wearing like male-like trousers, like just straight up and down in this like charcoal gray. And then I was wearing like this white shirt tucked in. And, you know, when you're a woman, like you have to be very careful about the shirts that you wear because they can, if they're not properly cut to your body, they can end up like really straddling you in a way that doesn't look that flattering because it just flattens you out. So you have to get a shirt with the right seaming and with like that extra button in the middle so that your chest isn't, there isn't a gap basically at the chest area. So I was like all strapped in. I was wearing like these charcoal gray trousers. I was wearing brogues. I was wearing like this cream, like old man trench coat. And you know, the only thing I didn't have was the briefcase, but honestly, I was not far off from even getting a briefcase. I'd contemplated it. I remember like just having this moment thinking like, what am I doing? Like, who am I? Like, why am I morphing into this person who's not me? And on top of that, I thought to myself, because sometimes you have these moments where you feel like you're outside of yourself, where you're observing yourself and you're taking yourself in and you're making observations about why it is you are behaving in this way. I also looked down on my manager, my boss, and I was like, I wonder what he thinks, seeing me reflect him, seeing me having morphed into him. It can't communicate strength on my behalf. It can't communicate confidence on my behalf. And on top of that, going back into myself in terms of how I feel in that moment, there's no way I'm bringing my full self into the workplace. There's no way that I'm like voicing my opinions. There's no way that I'm being just me, comfortable expressing myself, connecting with other people. Because what this showed me in that moment was how inferior I must have felt in that moment or in that space up to that point for me to over time have let go of all the little things that make me me in terms of how I show up physically in favor of showing up as somebody completely different to me and somebody who's like not just different but somebody I could never be. Like where the differences were so stark that there was never any assimilation that was possible, me being me and they being who they are. So imposter syndrome can also show up for women as like dressing like men, like dressing like the men in the spaces that they work, you know, instead of wearing like things that they might feel more comfortable in, things that naturally like fit their bodies better or that their bodies align with better, they'll end up wearing like male-like clothes. I even see this in like the choice of suits. Like let's say everybody has to wear a suit because that's just like the corporate culture. You can wear a suit that's fitted to a woman's body, or you can wear like a man type suit. And if you know what I mean, you know what I mean. Like you can wear like a beautiful dress that cinches you in and wear like a little jacket over it, and that's like the equivalent of like a woman's suit. Or you can wear like a straight cut suit that basically isn't designed for your body, and it kind of is evident when you are in a room with other men that you are wearing their, you're in drag basically, like you're wearing their costume. Except for them, it isn't a costume, it's just their clothes. Except for you, it becomes a costume. For people of color, this can also show up in like even just like their choice of clothes. Now, if you're a Black woman, like the colors that look great on you are not necessarily going to be the colors that look great on a white man. So white men tend to look, depending on their coloring, but for the most part, they look fantastic in like a navy suit. Like they, navy and like white skin looks really nice together, as does charcoal gray. Whereas with like people that like Black skin in particular, you want like maroon colors, dark brown colors. Even black looks much better than navy does, in my opinion, like when it comes to like a really sharp suit, although you want to avoid it looking like funeral like but that speaks to the expense of it, I would say, and the cut and all that stuff. So a Black woman wearing like a purple, like cinched in, like dark purple, dark plum color, like cinched in dress with like pretty heels and like a nice blazer, she's going to look much more alive and colorful and beautiful than her wearing like a charcoal gray pantsuit that is designed for like a man. Similarly, like if you're like somebody with like Asian skin, like imagine how delicious like a mustard yellow looks on like Indian skin or like that, like Asian skin. I'm not talking about East Asian, there's like a different color palette. It just brings the color tones alive. It brings them to the forefront. So my point here is the clothes that you wear sometimes can reflect how you're suppressing what you, like who you are and what naturally looks good on you. And the reason you're doing it is you're trying to fit in with the majority. And when the majority doesn't reflect you, even outside gender or ethnic or background considerations, you are not taking into account the fact that they are wearing what's best for them, what makes them feel powerful, what makes them feel professional, what makes them feel sexy, what makes them feel like attractive. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those things are going to look good on you, because they're doing what's good for them. They're not assimilating to you. They're not walking around wearing a brown cinched in dress as a like an old white man. They're not doing that. They're wearing what's best for them. And the thing about like when you keep wearing other people's costumes is that what it does is that it reinforces the idea that they are the standard and that you need to mold yourself to that standard. So it has like a really pernicious effect. Now, one of the ways to deal with imposter syndrome, I mean, there's lots of things, but one of the ways is at the very least to have a sanity check or to investigate some of those underlying assumptions. Because when you're walking around believing that you have everybody deceived and that they've made a mistake, like the hiring team have made a mistake, that your manager has made a mistake, that your colleagues have made a mistake, that in fact, you shouldn't be there. On the one hand, it speaks to a lack of self-confidence because you're saying that you don't deserve to be there when you do. But on the other hand, it's actually a little bit narcissistic in that it is assuming that you are this person that can deceive like dozens of people depending on your size of your workplace. It implies that you have been able to bamboozle like all these people, like the people you send your CV to, the people who end up like reading it for the first time, the people who narrow down the candidates, the people who interview you, the people who make the final decision, the people who like help you sign the contract. The people who end up managing you, the colleagues you end up working with, it means that you have been able to bamboozle all those people. And if you respect your colleagues' opinions and you respect your manager's opinions and you respect the other people involved in you getting the job, then you must also respect that they're able to make a good decision about who they hire. So they haven't made a mistake and you haven't been able to bamboozle them into getting a job that you don't deserve, essentially. And then also on top of that, like, you know, being cold-hearted about it, like, workplaces aren't charities. Like, if you weren't doing a good job, if you were losing their money, if it was costing them significantly more to train you because you couldn't keep up, they would not keep you hanging around. Like, you would not go past your probation. They would find a way to get rid of you. So trust and believe that, one, like, they're not going to keep you hanging around when you don't deserve to be because it doesn't make them money. But also, you know, you're not this evil genius person who can deceive all these people for all this time into not realizing that actually you shouldn't be there. So we have to, like, really try to separate our feelings from the facts, because, like, having, like, a fair, objective view of your life is actually a practice. It's not something that, when you have a tendency towards anxiety or nervousness or a negative positivity bias, like, practicing just being objective about things. And that means not being delusional about things. It doesn't mean that you are looking at something that's terrible and you're saying that it's good, or you're looking at a performance of yours that was objectively not good because the outside external indicators tell you that. Like, you've got a bad review, somebody sat you down and had a conversation with you, like, the results just speak for themselves. It doesn't mean you look at reality and tell yourself that that's not true. That's being delusional. But equally, taking in the world in a way that it isn't actually being reflected is also delusion. Like, if every single indicator outside of you is positive, so people have good relationships with you, you are given more work, you haven't been sat down to have a discussion about your subpar performance, if there's nothing in your HR file, if people even seem pleased and satisfied and complimentary of your work, they're all external indicators to tell you that you produce good work and that you are a good employee, and that you therefore have the proper skills and qualifications to be in that space. So refusing to see that, or not being able to see that, is also another sign of delusion, because it's being delusional about the state of reality. Only way to get around that is just practicing being fair. So being fair to other people, and that means not overestimating others in a way that invalidates you. So if somebody has produced good work, they've produced good work. They haven't produced exceptional work, though. They haven't produced extraordinary work. They've just produced good work. You're just being fair. And in instances where the work really is exceptional, you can acknowledge that and say they have produced exceptional work. So you're not overstating their achievements. It also means as well, though, that you end up practicing not underestimating your own abilities. So you practice being fair with yourself as well. So when you've produced good work, you say that was good work, or that was adequate work, or that was proportionate to what it should be, or I produced work that was as expected. And when you practice being fair to yourself and you practice being fair to other people, it, funnily enough, it makes you less, like, self-focused, because, like I said earlier, the irony is that it's actually quite self-aggrandizing to believe that you are able to deceive all these people unknowingly. So again, that's emblematic of the fact that you are being delusional. So practicing being fair means you're taking that away. Like, you're not assuming you're exceptionally bad or outside what the average should be, or outside what the typical should be, or outside what other people are doing. You're not doing that, but you're also not negatively comparing yourself to other people and coming up with the conclusion that you are worse. And to be honest, like, worst case scenario, like, the truth that people don't like to hear is that you're probably average. Like, you're not lower than average, you're not above average, like, you're in the median of numbers. Like, if you were to take all employees and line them up from worst performer to best performer, most people end up being in the middle. Like, they are part of the natural curve, you know, they're part of the bulk center. So the chances that you're an outlier, so you're either exceptional or terrible, is, like, mathematically very, very unlikely. And in these circumstances where your internal dialogue and internal self-perception differs to what the external indicators are and to what other people experience you as, it implies that you need an external point of view, because you can't trust your own voice, because your own voice always comes up overestimating other people and underestimating you. So in those circumstances, like, honestly, the best thing to do is to speak to somebody. And ideally, like, somebody professional, because the great thing about somebody who's professional is that one, like they see like a version of you every day. Like they see this kind of imposter syndrome or negative feelings about oneself or a negative inferior complex about themselves. They see it all the time. It's like run of the mill for them. So they can like find the symptoms like very, very quickly. And they can give you reassurance that what you are experiencing is a symptom of that thing. The great thing about speaking to somebody professional as well is that if you don't, like you can bare your soul and tell them about all your insecurities and all your fears and all these things without a fear that they are judging you, because you're literally paying them to listen to you. And also they're not judging you because they see this kind of thing all the time. So it's completely normal for them. But it also means that you can trust their voice because their voice is objective. It's not a friend you're speaking to who loves you and therefore they're going to give you something positive, which is going to feed into the fear that you have that you don't actually deserve to be there, but people are just too nice to tell you the truth. It's the same if you speak to friends, like family as well. Obviously, your family loves you and it can mean in your view that you don't trust what they have to say because people who love you are going to tell you nice things about yourself. But your problem is that you don't trust the nice things that they say and you don't trust the nice things that other people in your life say. So speaking to somebody professional sort of bypasses that because there's no love there for you, you know, in the nicest way possible, that you are a client to them and they're helping you get to the bottom of an issue and they see this kind of thing all the time. So you can actually feel a sense of comfort from hearing their words because you don't have that little voice in your head that's telling you it's just because they're your friends or family that are telling you things that you want to hear. And if money is a concern, as it is, you know, literally for everybody right now during the cost of living crisis, like try and have a bit of perspective about it because it's not as though you have to go forever. That was my impression before about therapy. Like you go and then for the rest of time you're in therapy or for a very long time you're in therapy, for like years you're in therapy until they get to like the root issue or why you are the way that you are, or why you're feeling the way that you're feeling. But that's not actually true. Like you can literally go for 2 to 3 sessions or a handful of sessions and you can tell them what your problem is and say that you would like a tune-up, essentially, just to speak to somebody to verbalize your feelings and to have somebody who's a professional take an assessment of those feelings. And then you're not locked in because it's not as though you sign a contract with them that says you have to keep coming to me for the next year. You can just go in for a few sessions. And if we have money to spend on things like, you know, just thinking about myself, like Netflix and an Amazon subscription and a Spotify subscription, if you take all that money and put it together, that's the cost of one session, essentially. And, you know, the more sort of I've thought about the value of mental health, the more that it's just so obvious that it's the most important thing in our lives because our minds control literally every single thing about us. It controls like what we think, what we do, how we behave, how we perceive the world, and therefore how we end up interacting with other people and with the things in our lives. And so if our central point of control, our minds, are out of whack for whatever reason, that's a big problem because every other aspects of our lives are affected. So instead of like spending money on going out to dinner or going to the cinema or going on a holiday or like spending money on these subscriptions, like the money should be directed into making sure that the control center is in a good position, that it is operating well, that it's not operating under stress and fear and anxiety, that it isn't distorting our view of the world, because that distortion isn't isolated. It literally shows up in every other areas of our lives. And that brings me to my next point as well, in that like things are interconnected by definition. So you kind of have to have a 360 view of your life. And what this means is if you are going through a difficult period or a troublesome period in one area of your life, a lot of the time it's going to bleed into other areas of your life. So if you're in a relationship that makes you feel bad about yourself, that isn't fulfilling, where the person takes away your sense of self-worth because let's say there's like infidelity that chips away at your self-confidence, or there's like verbal abuse that chips away at your self-confidence, or there's just a lack of reciprocity, as I spoke about in last week's episode, that chips away at your self-confidence. That is going to bleed into your work life as well. It's going to bleed into the relationships you have with your friends. These things are interconnected. It's going to breed a generalized sense of inferiority or of not being worthy. But sometimes one of the best things we can do is addressing the other areas in our lives, because they have a knock-on effect on our confidence and a knock-on effect on other areas of our lives. The final thing I'll say just on, around this topic, around the internal perception or our internal track that we have playing in our minds of what is said to ourselves and how we perceive the world, is there's like really interesting studies that show that when you say things, like a lot of the time your mind can't tell the difference between a truth and a lie. So if you say to yourself, you know, I am so good at this, and you say to yourself, or you say to yourself, I am terrible at this, your mind doesn't know which one is true. It just goes on the actual words that you are using. So it's that expression that, you know, what people say, like those who say they can't and those who say they can, those who say they can't and those who say they can are both right. It's essentially that, like what you're saying in your mind becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, in that you are, if you're saying that you are not capable, that you are not worthy, that you are not a valuable employee, in that you're not a valuable worker, you're going to end up behaving in ways that sort of fulfill that prophecy or confirm that negative bias that you're communicating to yourself. You should be beware of like the power of the tongue, especially as well when we're communicating these things to our colleagues as well. Because why I say go to a professional rather than just speaking to a work colleague is that, one, you know, if you go back to my episode where I talk about how your work colleagues are not your friends, the nature of the workplace means that we never truly know the people that we're working with, and we never know their agendas or motivations, which means that when we make ourselves vulnerable to them, we're taking a very high risk that that information could be circulated or in some other way could be used against us. So sometimes when we think that we're being vulnerable with a colleague because we're seeking connection, you know, sometimes what we're doing is actually we're giving them the key to our own destruction, in that they might end up communicating to other people that, you know, we aren't good at our jobs because that's what we said, or we are not as good as other people, or that we're not deserving of this promotion, or that we question our even like our right to be in that position. Like all those things end up being, or can end up being circulated in a way that ends up harming you, or in a way that ends up meaning that people take opportunities away from you, or they start to question your actions, or they start second guessing you. So it's much better to go to somebody who is external to the firm, and ideally to somebody who's trained in just recognizing what those symptoms are. But like either way, in the interim, like try as much as possible, because obviously I understand that the reason why you're doing this is because that's the way your mind operates, but try as much as possible to not communicate things that aren't true to yourself, because again, your mind will affirm whatever you tell it. And then finally, and this is what I had alluded to at the beginning of the episode, is that like the first part when I was talking about the imposter syndrome, a lot of the burden is placed on the individual. So it's about how they how the individual's mind works, how they interpret things around them, how they focus on the negative things as opposed to the positive things, how they doubt the positive indicators that they are doing well, that they are worthy of being there, that they're a valuable employee. They doubt all those positive things in favor of aligning with the negative sort of like self-speak that they have in their minds. So that's one interpretation. But the second interpretation, which I think this one allows you to be a lot more compassionate to yourself, is that actually the person is being falsely pathologized in a lot of ways, because like we all know that there is like a lot of biases in the hiring process, in promotions, in leadership, in compensation, so how much people are paid. And when that is the case, and the people who are operating in a system that is biased, for example, when you take women and you see that for the most part, like women who are doing the same work as men tend to be paid less for that work. It also is evident that they tend to be promoted at a much lower rate, and it takes them a lot longer, and they have to go through a higher hurdle rate to basically get that promotion. Now, when somebody's getting paid less than their counterpart and they're being promoted less than their counterpart, there are certain messaging that goes along with those two things. It means that the environment is going to be overestimating the value of the male equivalent, in that they're going to get a pat on the back and attaboy for the things that the women are doing who don't get credit for. It also means that they interpret the work of the men as being higher value than the work of the women. It also means that even like even like words like who is a leader and what a leader shows and what the skills that communicate leadership are highly biased in favor of men. So they'll say that a leader is somebody who goes fast, for example. They're a person who speaks up and voices their concerns. They're a person who like takes the reins, like all this language that we're used to hearing about what leadership communicates. But when you hear a lot of those words, in your mind, you imagine a man, because that's how the system is designed. It's designed to use adjectives that we have socialized men to display. However, actually, a lot of the studies show that when women are at the head of not only households, but also like organizations tend to be more profitable and they tend to undergo less issues. Like they're less likely to be sued for harassment. They're less likely to be sued for things like discrimination, because the way that female leadership works is more inclusive for one. It tends to be more consensus seeking. It tends to be more team focused. It tends to be less aggressive. And so all that, you know, bundle all of that up results in like the firm tending to do better. However, like that's in stark contrast to the kinds of people who get promoted. Like men get promoted at a higher rate because the system or the environment is designed to reward them and the skills that they display and also interpret those skills in a very particular way that advantages them. So what that means essentially is that in fact, like women are not like they're not being paranoid. Like it's not that the internal track in their heads is deceiving them. It is in fact true that they are doing the same things, but being rewarded for them differently. So a lot of women will talk a lot about being in a situation where they're in a meeting and they will make a suggestion that nobody listens to, at least the men in the room don't listen to. And then a few minutes later or a while later, another man will make the same contribution, but he will be recognized for that contribution. Or experiences in which their voices are literally spoken over in meetings and drowned out. Or the number of times that they are allowed to speak where the host, for example, or the presenter goes to them for an answer is just much less. So in those circumstances, when you are saying things that aren't being listened to, but somebody else is getting the credit for, when you're working harder, but getting less money, when you're being promoted at a lower rate, despite the fact that you work longer hours, that you have better team dynamics, that you have better ideas, then of course it's going to foster in you a sense of anxiety, a sense of being unsure about yourself, a sense that the environment around you is hostile. Naturally, no matter what the circumstances are, when we sense that the environment around us is hostile to our very being, it's hostile to our presence, it doesn't welcome us, it doesn't reward us, then of course what you're going to do is make yourself small, you're going to try and assimilate, you're going to overthink everything you do, you're going to second guess yourself, you're going to have this ingrained fear that somehow you're not good enough, that somehow you're not doing a good enough job, or that the people around you don't value your work and don't value your contributions. Because actually, in fact, that is what is happening. So one of the ways in which you can extend compassion to yourself is by recognizing that actually those people aren't there because they have earned their positions and that you have like not earned that position. A lot of the time, like for like, especially if you're a woman, you are likely to have earned your position more than they have, because in many ways, like the environment has already been primed for them. It's set up in a way where their contributions are going to be more highly regarded. They're more likely to be promoted, as I said. Their natural abilities are going to be labeled as good, appropriate, desirable. And so they have a lot less friction to go through to get to the position in the first place and then also to excel in that position. You, in contrast, have faced friction, you have faced rejection, you have faced an environment that is hostile to you, and you're still in that role. You're still doing the same job as they are. You're still doing the same work as they are doing. And therefore, you should feel proud about that, because you have succeeded despite the attempts to hold you back. So like when you walk into a space and you see that there are a lot more men present, don't assume it's because the men are better And that's why they're more represented in that space. No, it's just a symptom of sexism, essentially. It just tells you that they are the beneficiaries of positive bias that means that they show up in larger numbers. And that's the same thing as well for like POCs as well. One of the things that I really, really hate is when an artist, either a female artist or an artist of color, wins like an award. They win like an Academy Award, for example, and in their speech, they will say something to the effect of, I'm so proud to be the first insert whatever. So I'm so proud to be the first person of color, or I'm so proud to be the first woman winning this award. And the reason why it really annoys me is that the implication, therefore, is that they are like some special unicorn to have won the award. So the reason why they're the first is because they're so great. When in fact, the reason why they're winning their award is because other people, other women who are equally as great, equally as talented, equally as amazing, didn't get that award because the Academy Award itself is sexist. And it's only now under pressure that they are forced to tell different types of stories that center women, that center people of color. And therefore, those people have opportunities to actually win an award. So really, the speech shouldn't be like, you know, I'm so proud I'm the first to win this. It should be something to the effect of, you know, well done the Academy for finally giving women opportunities, or POCs opportunities. You know, the emphasis is on the wrong actor. It's almost blaming the previous artists that have come before this current artist for not winning the award, when actually they should be blaming the Academy for the fact that they have previously or historically prevented women POCs from getting these opportunities. So it's sort of like the same thing as what I've been talking about, where imposter syndrome can be interpreted in the first way that I spent a lot of the episode discussing, and it's still valid, discussing women and people's internalized feelings of inferiority, basically. But the second one is also that we have to have an institutional or a systemic lens on things as well, because a lot of the time, the reason why it's a specific segment of the population that is more affected by imposter syndrome is because the environment itself is designed to communicate that message. And also the environment itself, like, basically doesn't give these people opportunities to be validated. So walking into like all male spaces doesn't validate women's experiences or women as a group, because the space communicates that they shouldn't be there. Therefore, it's natural that they should feel out of place, or feel like they don't belong, or feel like maybe they ought not to be there, because that's literally what the space is designed to do, and that's what the space is doing. And so when we don't take an institutional view on this or a systemic view on this, we're kind of gaslighting people. We're kind of saying like it's all in your head. And some of it is in your head. Like, some inferiority complexes really are internally driven and aren't that externally connected, but actually a great deal of inferiority complexes come about as a result of what the environment is communicating to us. Now, the final thing I'll say is I came across this great thought that I hadn't thought about. And it's the idea that basically capitalism as a whole is kind of designed to make us all feel like imposters, because a lot of the messaging, when you pick up like a business focused newspapers, when you even just like the things are out there when it comes to self improvement and self-development, a lot of it is based on being more productive, producing more, doing like fitting more things into less time, like creating more value. All like capitalism is kind of designed to make you feel like you're not working hard enough, that you're not giving enough, that you could be working harder. And therefore, if that's the general society that tells us that the value of a human being is connected to how quote unquote productive they can be, then of course it is simultaneously breeding in all of us this sense that we are not living up to our expectations, that we are not working hard enough, that we are not smart enough, that we are not being as productive as we could be. And therefore, we're comparing ourselves to other people, you know, from our point of view. So-and-so gets up at 5 a.m. and they've done these things before they even go to work. This person does, you know, a second, third job, or this person has a side hustle. This person's writing a book on top of that. That person makes, you know, you're comparing yourself all the time to all these people in a way where you always end up feeling short. And to some extent, Like, that is by design. Like, it's the kind of environment that we all operate in now, where we're always like striving for like this endless progress. And that progress, you know, it's never even just like the progress is like in self-actualization. It's about how connected you can be to other human beings. It's never about how spiritual you can be or how kind and helpful and charitable you can be. A lot of the time, like, progress is interpreted as one way, and it's basically like how to work harder, how to make more money, and how to be a better form than our former selves. And all that, the net effect of all that is that a lot of people walk around feeling as though they're not good enough and feeling like other people are doing more than they are. And that's kind of like at the root of what imposter syndrome, in like a very generalized way, it's this feeling that other people are essentially outpacing you. They're outperforming you along all these metrics, educationally, productive-wise, promotion-wise, career-wise. And all these different comparisons that we're making to other people end up breeding this inherent sense of being unsure of yourself, of feeling as though other people are doing better than you, are progressing quicker than you, are outperforming you, like I said. And if that is like the internal track that's playing in our minds all the time, then of course we're going to feel like imposters in many areas of our lives. Like, I spoke mostly about in the workplace, but it also shows up in our relationships, in our interpersonal relationships. And the only way out of that is, you know, some of the things that I said, but the biggest one is practicing that self-compassion that comes from realizing that a lot of how you feel are a direct consequence of the environment that you're operating in. A lot of the time, the environment is telling you all those negative words that you're using against yourself. You're getting it from somewhere, and you're getting it from the people and the environment and the system that you're operating in. And so with that, I'm going to wrap up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in and for listening to the episode until the very end. If you enjoyed this episode and other episodes, it would be really great if you could leave me a review on wherever you listen to your podcasts. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the role of propaganda and some of the propaganda that is perpetrated on the left and some of the propaganda that is propagated on the right. And I'll be dropping the episode on Monday, as it's going to be my regular post day, as it has been for quite some time. But yeah, thank you so much, and I'll catch you in the next one.